households are expected to pare back their celebrations. Councils and businesses are also cutting festivities to save cash. Britons have decided they will buy no presents at all this year, with many concentrating on stockings and gifts for their children, grandchildren, nieces and nephews to ensure they don't miss out. The Christmas cutbacks will also be obvious in many homes, with some not buying a tree, putting up lights and asking for jumpers and slippers as presents so they can keep the heating off over the festive period. One emergency worker tweeted in this regard, "That is the trouble. I am just not buying anything other than essentials at the moment. And our family have decided to do a secret Santa for Christmas present, so we all just have to buy one present and we'll receive one, up to the value of £30, exception for children, through." Another said, "Decided not doing presents. Usually we do a secret Santa within the family, but this year life is too stressful for that, and we are cutting costs. No cards either. I'll freeze a few bits for a nice Xmas lunch. That's be it." In the outside world, businesses have been axing Christmas parties for staff. Restaurants are also expected to close on Christmas Day and run reduced hours during the holidays due to the cost of heating, lighting, and staffing the kitchen and the restaurant. Sarah Hall, founder of Waterlooville-based The Silk Purse Guild, said, "We have already put our Christmas tree up so that it feels festive for as long as possible. The lights on it are solar powered as we can't afford to power them through the mains. My husband and I have bought each other a pair of fluffy sleepers each, and that's it. We will be wearing them on Christmas Day to stave off the cold and watch movies all the day. I bought all of my Christmas presents in July, and I knew that things were going to be difficult this year. We will be watching all the pennies and trying to get bargains from everything from the turkey to the Brussels sprouts. I work with hundreds of artisan businesses who are dependent on Christmas as they make gifts, and it's going to be a brutally tough one for them all." The Financial Times also reported its key supplier Wee Butteril and Son lost its entire flock of 18,000 birds to bird flu. They were encouraging customers to choose beef. Chris Godfrey of Godfrey's Butchers in Highbury, London, told the newspaper, "The situation is actually dire. We sell very premium quality free-range animals that all live outside the rummage around. The intensive farms are not hit as badly in the sense they can have sealed barns," he said. "Orders are coming at a manic pace." Sainsbury's chief executive Simon Roberts said this month, "The good news is that about a third of our turkey volume comes from frozen, and we have ordered more turkeys this year than we sold last year. The teams will be working very hard to fill any gaps as far as we can," he added. "Although turkey remains a key part of our Christmas offer, increasingly customers are looking at other products. There has been a real move into beef in recent years. Fewer than half of households will be eating turkey and all the trimmings at Christmas for the first time as shoppers gobble up alternatives." Also, according to Financial Times, a shopkeeper said the restaurants all over the UK will be closed over Christmas or opening less to save money on heating and stuff. She told reporters it's a worrying time. Price increases are thick and fast, and the more out of control it gets, the harder it is to run a business. We can't pass on all the increases we are paying, otherwise people will be paying in excess of £10 a pint, which is not sustainable or feasible given for many. That is a luxury item. We are trying to absorb cost where possible, but we are seeing suppliers pass on their entire price increases to us, which is unsustainable. It's impossible to predict. It could go higher. We don't know, but it feels out of control. Given Christmas was largely cancelled last year, it will be really interesting to see what people do and how people spend and save. We are seeing huge fluctuations. Bookings are up for Christmas because Christmas celebrations were cancelled last year. We are seeing Christmas happen later because of the World Cup, and we are seeing restaurants open for shorter hours, mainly due to heating and staffing cost. We are trying as a business to ride the wave, but for smaller businesses, there will be a lot of pain to come.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the documentary, we went to Singapore, an island city-state off southern Malaysia, where 5.2 million people call home. Singapore is a global financial center where one in four have a university degree and 90% own a home. By all counts, Singapore is prosperous, rich, and safe. But this is not the whole story. A 2010 survey shockingly revealed that over 9% of women in Singapore experience physical or sexual abuse from their partners, and one-third of these domestic violence victims have a college degree. We followed the stories of Rachel, Mira, and Vu as they shared their experiences of abuse, victimization, and shame. But as bad as violence and abuse is for any woman, and the situation is much worse for women who are migrants living in a foreign country, as we shall see in the rest of the program.
In 1994, Vu met and married her Singaporean husband in Ho Chi Minh City. She was 21 and he was 41. Shortly after, Vu and her husband returned to Vietnam so that her family could help look after the baby. This was when his true nature was exposed. Hoping for a better education for her daughter, Vu agreed to move back to Singapore. That was 15 years ago. Vu's husband's addiction to gambling often led to fights, but she learned to hit back. Although she could defend herself physically, he had other ways of punishing her. To remain in Singapore, Vu required a long-term social visit pass, which was renewed yearly. This visa requires a guarantor, her husband.
The law recognizes that when someone hurts you physically, threatens you, confines you, harasses you, then that's a violation of your rights. The law does not state that if when someone abuses you verbally, emotionally, that's a violation of your rights. And so protection under the law may not be extended to the individual under those circumstances. But does it make it right? Of course not.
For the first few years, Vu was financially dependent on her husband and mother-in-law, but she slowly worked her way to independence. To make ends meet, she sold donated clothes at the Sungai Road street market. For the past 4 years, Vu has held a stable job at a fast food restaurant. With help from charities and aid agencies, her children's education is paid for. She is the breadwinner now, but her husband still holds some of the cards. Vu wants to leave her husband, but first, she needs to make sure that her right to reside in Singapore is secure. In 2 years, Vu's daughter will be 21, the required age to become her mother's guarantor in Singapore. It's the promise of the life that comes after that keeps Vu going day by day. Whether or not her dream can become reality remains to be seen.
Some foreign spouses will find it difficult to get citizenship or PR because they don't have a lot of education and also are married to men who themselves don't have a lot of education, lowly skilled, and they are seen as not being able to contribute that significantly to the Singapore economy. Because our immigration policy is very much tied to one's economic or potential economic contribution, the chances of getting the PR or citizenship are not so high. I think the immigration policy should definitely be reviewed. One, there should be some criteria so that foreign spouses can work towards making sure that in time they can actually acquire citizenship. Two, there should be some points given, you know, and a lot of points given for the fact that they have children in Singapore. And if the children are Singapore citizens, it really doesn't help the family that their mother has got such a uncertain citizenship status.
Victims of domestic violence transcend race, income, and educational background. One in three victims in Singapore have a university degree, and they are even more likely to stay silent.
There's a lot of victim blaming still going on, you know, and the very fact that people still think that, you know, I'm washing dirty linen, you know, in public when I talk about these things, you know.
Why have we still not come to a point in society where people are willing to intervene?
It's a private matter. It's between a husband and a wife. You should not interfere.
That domestic violence is a private matter.
We don't know all the facts. There's another side to the story.
I think the reason that that's so difficult, and I think you hit on two things that are really important that I think are sorely lacking right now in our society, which are one, empathy, and two, imagination. Mm-hmm. And in Singapore, these are two qualities that are not at all considered to be that important.
Once there were only two. Then it became four. Soon there will be six universities in Singapore. And more than 48% of university graduates are women. Both Rachel and Mira are professionals in the marketing industry. And like many other successful women, they have struggled with the issue of shame.
I didn't want people to know that, you know, I was like one of the statistics, you know, abused wife, and then, you know, the pity, and then, you know, the whispering, the gossiping and all that. I really didn't want any of that. So I very stupidly, you know, just kept it to myself. I didn't say anything. I just put it all upon myself, you know, to try to solve the problem.
I didn't want my family to feel that I've married a terrible person, nothing. I wanted him to be respected. I didn't want to go to my family and say, this is what my husband is doing to me.
According to the International Violence Against Women survey in 2010, almost one in three victims in Singapore have a degree or postgraduate credentials.
The fact that we found a disproportionately higher number of women who were victims of violence who had university or postgraduate qualifications hammers home the point that education alone is not enough. We have done well economically, we have done well in terms of, you know, earning capacity. But in terms of how we are as a society, our values, what we see as important, perhaps there's a lot more room for improvement.
Why did these professional women stay silent?
So educated women will feel that they should be able to handle anything that happens in their family. right, including violence. And so they are not going to readily tell another party. In fact, they often try to deal with it themselves, and they are less likely to tell their friend or family member because they're much more embarrassed.
It's not just got to do with the income and the education, but really a lot has got to do also with the beliefs that we hold.
Shame, embarrassment, saving the family honor.
Perhaps it has something to do with the fact that when I think about drawing attention to my problems, I draw attention to not just shaming me as a person, but shaming my family, my community.
But if victims remain silent, do family and friends have the responsibility to speak out? That is Robert's dilemma. He has known Luke and Lena for 30 years.
I actually did not believe that he would do such a thing. So when she told me about it, she said, I don't think I want to be with him. So I told her, well, give yourself a bit of time, think about it.
Robert never imagined that his friend could be a wife beater.
We always tell him, if you've got a good wife, then just, you know, control yourself. Oh no, I love my wife. I love my wife very much. I will not do such a thing. But we can see, you know, a few times when myself and my spouse met this couple, we could see on her face the black and blue marks hidden under the makeup.
When Robert accepted that his friend Luke was an abusive husband, he offered help.
I tried to help her by asking her if she needs any, you know, advice from lawyers, and if she needs to get away from him, you know, we could help her find a place.
But fear has kept Lena under her own roof.
If she were to leave him, she thinks that she will lose whatever she's put into the home. And she may lose her son also.
Family violence professionals believe that the community has a larger role to play.
Violence will only stop if the society actually is more proactive, because it is really the people around the victim that have much more choices than the victim, much more choices to do something about the problem.
For most people, the hardest part is knowing when to take action and how far to go.
I have this fear factor in me that what happens in their home behind closed doors is very private. And the fear is, if I were to actually interfere in their private affairs, it may backfire. So either party has to make the first step.
Without an explicit cry for help, Robert feels he cannot act further.
If she comes to me physically and say, look, this is what has happened to me, with all the bruises and all the black and blue marks on her face or arms, I would personally think that I will bring her to a police station to make a report. But she has never at one time said, yes, help me, or I will follow your advice. So I'm in a very difficult position to report this matter to the authorities.
When is the right time to act?
There's something called the battered wife syndrome, and there are people who have been in victim mentality for many, many years, right? And the children see it, right? But are powerless, right? And so I think in some cases, you actually need to allow people like their children or even social workers to help them take that first step and to initiate the process, because otherwise they will continue to be in this situation.
Now that her son is about close to 30 years old, he's still single, she did bring this subject up to him and ask him that, she told him that one of these days I'm going to walk out of the house. I hope you will not blame me and you will support me. His answer to her regret was, this is a problem between you and Dad. Don't get me involved. It really broke her heart. And she said all this while she's been living in the home for the son, yeah. And now with him saying this few words to her, she was really very disappointed.
So what do you think were Xu Hui's beliefs, though?
At workshops run by advocacy groups like AWARE, gender stereotypes are being questioned.
You should be submissive.
I accept.
You should be a housewife.
You should be able to cook.
It's your job to look after the children.
You should keep the family together.
I accept.
Breadwinner.
I accept.
Macho.
You shouldn't cry.
I accept.
You're always right.
Oh. I accept.
You are a role model.
I accept.
Without a shift in societal attitudes, responses to domestic abuse remain unchanged.
There are three typical responses when a person is confronted with domestic violence. One is to deny that it exists. Turn the other way. Don't deal with it. The other is to acknowledge it exists, but to minimize it. To say that this is a once-off thing. To say that it only affects the poorer community, the less educated, the migrants. And when these two initial responses isn't adequate, the third response is always to blame the victim.
Hearts, minds, attitudes. These are the keys to shaping a better future.
So you can do case management till the cows come home. Every case, you empower the woman, you give her all her options, and then she finds a solution, right? But it just keeps happening, right? So until you try to change, until you change the societal attitudes, it's going to continue, and you're just going to have cases continue all the time. Yeah, so we really have to, even though it's long-term, it might take 10 years, even more, but we have to start somewhere. So this is the driving force behind the weekend campaign. It's the first time that we're actually doing a campaign that lasts more than a year, but we think this is necessary, right? So we plan for at least a three-year campaign, and we say if it has to be a community effort, right? So we are really just the catalyst. We provide the tools, and we try to inspire people to think about the problem and how they themselves can be part of the solution.
I would like to encourage others to not submit to other people's expectations of you.
My change is to remind people of their freedom of choice and their right to choose.
My change is to start believing in myself well. Then I think I can help others believe in themselves as well.
Mine was not a physical abusive relationship, but it was more mental and psychological that slowly deteriorated my sense of self-worth over that 24 period time frame. So I think that what, as a woman, I would like to do is reclaim my sense of self-worth and then teach my daughters what it means to be a powerful woman.
When I share my story, you know, people will say things like, what did you do? Did you do something to make him behave that way, you know? There's a lot of victim blaming still going on, you know. And the very fact that people still think that, you know, I'm washing dirty linen, you know, in public when I talk about these things, you know. But I'm very fortunate in a way that my children are very supportive of what I do. They are very proud of the work I do, you know. The more I see this, the more I feel that, you know, I should share that there's really nothing wrong in facing our demons, you know, straight on.
Mira, too, is no longer a victim.
Every day for the rest of my life, when I look into the mirror, I'm going to see that scar. But it's a scar that will tell me that I tried. I tried really hard. I got into a relationship eyes wide open with hope. However, I used to look at it and cry. Not anymore. I look at it and I feel brave about it and I tell myself I survived. I survived because of very strong family support, really good, strong friends. Friends who made sure that I was going to be strong, accepted me, allowed me to cry. I came out of a toxic marriage. Today, if I see a woman get beat up by a man, I will go and help the woman. I don't care how big that guy is going to be. I don't care if that guy is going to use vulgarities on me, but I would go rescue that woman.
Today, Rachel proudly stands her ground and openly tells her story so that other women don't have to face the same ordeal alone.
Is there any other point?
You always feel that, you know, why is this happening to me, you know, especially when you look around and, you know, people are having happy marriages, happy families, you know. And you will feel like, you know, you're so alone in the world, you know, that it's only happening to you. And that's the reason why I'm speaking out about this, you know, so that other women will know that it is not only just happening to them.
Breaking the suffocating silence is the first step in ending the issue of domestic violence and abuse. Women enduring such horrific conditions must find the courage and strength to speak out and seek help. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. But before we go, remember you can contact us either through email, Facebook, or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kHz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sadarbat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Russian news agencies are saying former U.S. intelligence contractor Edward Snowden, who fled prosecution after revealing highly classified U.S. government surveillance programs, has received a Russian passport and taken the oath of citizenship. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Associated Press has covered this story. Former U.S. intelligence contractor Edward Snowden, who fled prosecution after revealing highly classified surveillance programs, has received a Russian passport and taken the oath of citizenship, according to Russian news agencies, quoting his lawyer on Friday. Lawyer Anthony Kucherena was reported as saying that Edward Snowden got the passport and took the oath of allegiance on Thursday, about 3 months after Russian President Vladimir Putin granted him citizenship. The reports did not specify whether Snowden has renounced his U.S. citizenship. The United States revoked his passport in 2013, leading to Edward Snowden being stranded in a Moscow airport for weeks after arriving from Hong Kong, aiming to reach Ecuador. Russia eventually granted him permanent residency. He married the American citizen Lindsay Mills in 2017, and the couple have now 2 children. In Washington, State Department spokesman Ned Price said on Friday that the United States was aware of reports that Edward Snowden had finalized his Russian citizenship but could not confirm them, and referred questions about his status to the Russian government. However, Ned Price said the Biden administration would not be surprised if the reports were indeed correct. Mr. Snowden has long signaled his allegiance to Russia. This step would only formalize that, Ned Price told reporters. Edward Snowden leaked documents on the National Security Agency's collection of data passing through the infrastructure of U.S. phone and internet companies. He also released details about the classified U.S. intelligence budget and the extent of American surveillance on foreign officials, including leaders of countries allied to the United States. Edward Snowden says he made the disclosures because he believes the U.S. intelligence community had gone too far and infringed on civil liberties. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and gives us more detail. Edward Snowden has received a Russian passport after swearing an oath of allegiance to the country that has sheltered him from US authorities since 2013, his lawyers have said. Edward Snowden, a 39-year-old, a former intelligence contractor who leaked secret files, was granted Russian citizenship in an order signed by Russian President Vladimir Putin in September. On Friday, Edward Snowden's lawyer, Anatoly Kucherena, said Snowden had received his passport. He took the oath of allegiance, he said. The decision has come at an extremely inauspicious moment. Anatoly Kucherena said on Friday that Edward Snowden was happy and that Russian citizenship would prevent him from being extradited to the United States. He, of course, is happy and thankful to the Russian Federation for his citizenship. He's now a fully-fledged citizen of Russia, Kucherena said. And most importantly, under the Russian constitution, he cannot be given up to a foreign state. Kucherena could not immediately be reached for further comment. In Washington, State Department spokesman Ned Price said the United States was aware of reports that Edward Snowden had finalized his Russian citizenship, and said the Biden administration would not be surprised if the reports were in actual fact correct. Mr. Snowden has long signaled his allegiance to Russia. This step would only formalize that, Ned Price told reporters and journalists. Individuals receiving Russian citizenship are required by law to pledge to observe the constitution and legislation of the Russian Federation, the rights and freedoms of its citizens, to fulfill the duties of a citizen of the Russian Federation for the benefit of the state and society, to protect the freedom and independence of the Russian Federation, and to be loyal to Russia and to respect its culture, history, and traditions. Edward Snowden's wife, Lindsay Mills, is also said to be applying for Russian citizenship. They live at an undisclosed location in Russia with their 2 sons, who were both born in Russia. Edward Snowden wrote in September, "After years of separation from our parents, my wife and I have no desire to be separated from our sons. After 2 years of waiting and nearly 10 years of exile, a little stability will make a difference for my family. I pray for privacy for them and for us all. VOA News has also covered the same story and gives us more detail. Former US intelligence contractor Edward Snowden, who exposed the scale of secret surveillance by the National Security Agency, NSA, has sworn an oath of allegiance to Russia and received a Russian passport, according to Russia's Itatas news agency. Yes, he got a passport, he took the oath, Anatoly Kucherena, Edward Snowden's lawyer, told the Itatas news agency. Snowden, a 39-year-old, did not immediately reply to a message seeking comment on the report. Russian President Vladimir Putin in September granted Russian citizenship to Edward Snowden, who fled the United States after leaking secret files that revealed the extensive eavesdropping activities of the US government and even eavesdropping on world statesmen and countries which are allies to the United States. Defenders of Edward Snowden hail him as a modern-day dissident for exposing the extent of US spying. Opponents say he's a traitor who endangered lives by exposing the secret methods that Western spies use to listen in on hostile states and on militants.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. The Americans currently have bases in many different regions, including our region, in Europe, in Asia. They have populated military bases whose expenses are paid by taking money from the poor country in which the base is located. These countries are expected to cover the expenses, while the Americans sit back and lord over them. This will be over soon. The United States will have to pack its bags and leave these different places in the world. This is the first main line of the basic lines that form the new order of the future world. The second basic line is the transfer of political, economic, cultural, and even scientific power from the West to Asia. Today, Western powers have political authority, scientific authority, cultural authority, and economic authority. They have many things. However, perhaps a more accurate interpretation would be to say they had these things, but are gradually losing them. But they had these for many years. The West acted like this for two or three centuries. In the new order, This state will be transferred from the West to Asia. Asia will become the center of knowledge, the center of economics, as well as the center of political power and the center of military power. And we are in Asia. That is the second point.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The third basic line includes the expansion of the idea of resistance and the resistance front against coercion. The initiator of this is the Islamic Republic, because ever since the Industrial Revolution took place and the Europeans started advancing and colonizing other countries, they made the people and the countries of the world get used to the fact that submission and dominance are two inevitable corresponding parts of the world.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Now, some countries and some international cooperation platforms have begun to coordinate attempts to de-dollarization, such as BRICS. In the context of the weakening U.S. dollar hegemony, developing countries all over the world need a more stable type of financial mechanism as a new channel for conducting financial transactions. The BRICS and other international platforms are trying to work out solutions. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT in a report wrote, the two nations have been promoting settlements in national currencies, referring to Russia and China. The transition to trade in national currencies between Russia and China will contribute to a global de-dollarization process. China's charged offer in Russia said this week at a conference on Russian-Chinese relations. Son Weidong said, noting that bilateral trade has risen dramatically, mostly on energy and agricultural supplies, the existing economic partnership between China and Russia and the long-term accumulated level of trade have laid a solid foundation for further deepening cooperation between our countries. Energy cooperation continues to play an important role in relations between the two countries. In addition, agricultural products and seafood from Russia are increasingly entering the Chinese market, the diplomat said, adding, "We have cooperation on major projects in the field of nuclear energy, aircraft construction, rocket engines, satellite navigation. In addition, payments are constantly being made in local currencies." Russia and its trading partners have been expanding the share of national currencies in mutual settlements in an attempt to move away from the US dollar and the euro. In recent years, Moscow has been steadily following a policy of de-dollarization of foreign trade, particularly expanding the use of Chinese currency for buying financial products denominated in yuan and using it as a reserve currency. Trade between the two nations hit $136 billion in the first 9 months of this year, jumping by over 30% in annual terms, according to the National Bureau of Statistics of China. Moscow and Beijing aim to increase bilateral trade to a $200 billion target this year. In this regard, Global Times wrote, Egypt will develop a new currency indicator partly to reframe the idea that the Egyptian pound should be pegged to the US dollar, the country's central bank governor said, according to Reuters. As a strong dollar has become a hazard for global economy, economies around the world have realized the urgency of de-dollarization. Many countries have started their own exploration according to their national condition to tackle the impact caused by the U.S. highly reckless and irresponsible financial policy. The new currency indicator of Egypt is a helpful trial among countries aiming for de-dollarization. In order to tackle the spillover impacts from the U.S. tightened monetary policy on other countries, many countries across the world have started their de-dollarization exploration in ways including using bilateral and multilateral currency agreements to settle transactions in international trade, promoting the diversification of foreign exchange reserves, and reducing U.S. Treasury holdings. De-dollarization is not a voluntary choice made by countries such as Egypt, but a forced response to the weaponization of the dollar. The strong U.S. dollar policy exacerbating serious inflation, currency devaluation, and capital outflow in developing countries. To avoid being dragged into a crisis, de-dollarization has become an increasing priority for those nations. Admittedly, it is not an easy task to avoid being pulled into a financial crisis caused by the dollar. There still remain uncertainties in their efforts to cope with current financial problems. They still face mounting challenges in how to maintain financial market and foreign trade stability and take proper measures and steps to avert a crisis. Ending dollar hegemony in the world is not an easy goal, but the process has already begun, and momentum will become more obvious and stronger over time. And more countries join. It is now necessary for the world to explore how different countries should work together to coordinate their efforts to address the common challenge of the US dollar hegemony and maintaining the stability of the world monetary system while de-dollarization gathers pace. Now, some countries and some international cooperation platforms have begun to coordinate attempts on de-dollarization, such as BRICS. In the context of the weakening U.S. dollar hegemony, developing countries all over the world need a more stable type of financial mechanism as a new channel for conducting financial transactions. The BRICS and other international platforms are trying to work out solutions. In June, Russia proposed at a BRICS-related meeting that it is advancing the development of a reserve currency based on the BRICS basket of currencies. As early as 2019, Germany, the UK, and France established the INTEC system to help European companies bypass US dollar settlements, and now more and more countries have joined the system. In Asia, the Central Bank of India launched a rupee settlement mechanism for international trade in July. Five ASEAN economies reached a consensus in July to plan to establish a regional integrated payment network to bypass the US dollar for direct foreign exchange settlements. It is worth exploring how all parties should strengthen global coordination. Strengthening global coordination for de-dollarization is fundamentally a political decision, not an economic one, for many economies around the world. Facing the new geopolitical landscape and the impact of a strong dollar, countries across the world should take a longer-term view and strive to strengthen de-dollarization coordination.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The repercussions of the war in Yemen and the difficult economic conditions continue to take a heavy toll on Yemeni patients. Yemen's Ministry of Public Health and Population held a press conference to shed light on the impact of the continued Saudi siege on thalassemia patients. Those suffering from this disease need to get blood transfusions every 3 weeks and must stay on medication for life.
Our main concern is the lack of medicines for thalassemia patients. These medicines, if available, are very expensive in addition to the lack of necessary medical examinations. We have 20,000 registered patients, while the real numbers are many times higher. These children need special medical care, and we hope that international organizations will stand by them by providing them with what they need.
The Yemeni Health Ministry has recorded nearly 500 deaths due to the lack of only one of the drugs used to treat thalassemia. The ones grappling with the disease seem to be losing hope as time goes by. With their health constantly deteriorating, they are desperately asking for help from international organizations, including the UN.
We suffer a lot from thalassemia. Medicines are not available. We need expensive medicines such as growth injections. We also suffer from a shortage of blood donors, which is what we need continuously.
We greatly need to be provided with important medicines that have not been available since the beginning of the war, such as iron withdrawal treatments. Because our iron level is high due to frequent blood transfusions, which also causes frequent infections.
Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and the ensuing shortages of food and medicine is putting more lives at risk every day. The healthcare system is feeling a massive strain, and the international community has yet to take any definitive steps towards ending the crisis here. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Did
The Italian government has been authorized to send, when it sees fit, military assets, materials and equipment to Ukraine until December 31st next year. The go-ahead has arrived from Italy's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, which has passed a motion presented by the right-leaning parties backing the government coalition and supported by some opposition groups, including centre-left Democratic Party and centrist Italia Viva Azione. Italy has so far classified the arms it has been sending to Ukraine, but some media have suggested the next package will likely include air and missile defence.
9 months after the start of the conflict, sending weapons to Ukraine is no longer the way to go. We must put peace talks on the table and work all together for a UN-backed peace conference promoted by the EU.
Support for Ukraine has been a contentious issue within the ruling coalition, with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni positioning herself as a staunch supporter of Kiev. However, her partners Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi, respectively leaders of the League and Forza Italia parties, have been so far much more ambiguous due to their historical ties with Moscow and President Vladimir Putin. The two have repeatedly stressed the urgency of stepping up efforts to promote peace negotiations.
Giorgia Meloni is firmly and strongly linked or attached to the partnership and the alliance in with the United States and with NATO. So I don't think she will do something to promote compromises or peaceful or diplomatic solution.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has recently said, quote, "The Western alliance intends to keep fighting for Ukraine until it wins back all the territory Russia has seized since 2014. However, there seems to be an open wedge between the parliament and the Italian people. Latest polls show that more than half of Italians advocate for peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, and only a third are okay with a country sending more weapons to Kiev.
Peace talks must be started now. They have to find a solution to end this war. This situation is dangerously taking us toward a brink.
We are being run by governments of weaklings in the pocket of NATO, and the Meloni government is no different. Our constitution clearly says Italy rejects war.
It's not anymore a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's about all of us. We begin to feel exhausted.
The approval of the motion in the lower house on supplying weapons to Ukraine also included a provision which increases military spending to 2% of GDP by 2028, as required by NATO. The motion is currently under discussion at the upper house. The Senate will have the final say on the matter. Max Civili, Rome.
Pakistan has hosted a dialogue platform for the OIC member states to boost cooperation among them in the field of science and technology. Senior officials representing Iran, Kazakhstan, Tunisia, Qatar, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Pakistan attended the meeting, while Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Turkey, Azerbaijan, United Arab Emirates, and Cameroon participated via video conference. The first senior officials' meeting of the OIC Forum was aimed at strengthening scientific cooperation and to encouraging major technological initiatives.
This forum provides us opportunities of bilateral, multilateral cooperation. So one or two or several countries can work together. With Iran, of course, we have a very strong cultural, historical and scientific collaboration. And of course, Pakistan and Iran can work together.
Iran's Deputy Science Minister Peyman Salehi told the meeting that OIC was established to strengthen unity and collaboration among Islamic countries. He offered the participants Iran's cooperation in the field of science and technology.
This collaboration between 15 countries may have a very fruitful outcome in near future. Therefore, we arrange for the first meeting of ministers that will be held, I think, about 4 to 6 months later.
The Iranian minister further said that despite the sanctions imposed by the West, Iran is self-sufficient in the field of science and technology and has invested big in its infrastructure and commercialization of technology.
In 2021, Iranian scientists published about 78,000 papers, peer-reviewed papers in international journals, and at the moment we are in the rank 15 in the world. We have established about 50 science and technology